All right, thank you. Pleasure to be here and to tell you about what the memory formation program is about. And I am going to start with some generalities about what memory means to all of us and what it means in particular for the participants and proposers of this program then. And I'll do this by first sort of setting the stage by giving some very everyday examples to set the terminology. And then I'll tell you about what kind of memory effects are of interest to the memory formation in MATLAB program. And then I'll do this by giving you a set of examples which illustrate the kind of problems that are of interest. And then I'll sort of use that to talk about what are the general features of the kind of systems that we're interested in, what are the kind of questions, and what seem to be interesting directions for us to think in terms of, okay? So, if I just start with the word memory, for most of us in an arbitrary context, this connotes human memory. And I can think of that as a faculty of mind that allows me to encode, store, and retrieve information, and occasionally erase information, though mostly involuntarily. And it could also mean a piece of information that is encoded and stored in this way, right? So we will largely be thinking of the latter connotation of memory being some information that is encoded somehow and stored in the physical systems that we are going to be looking at. Okay, and then we will be interested in how that memory can be retrieved and how it can be erased Okay, so like I said, these will be illustrated in through some examples. Now, sticking to the human memory context for the moment, this is of course so this is one of many interesting biological examples, and one can sort of enumerate a list, which I won't, but I'll just mention one particularly interesting example that we heard a couple of weeks ago from Mehran Kardar, which is immunological memory, right? So the formation of memories through various kinds of operations and their storage, again, by different chemical and physical means is something that's a very important part of biological function. And so we won't be very interested in that aspect of memory in this program, though whenever possible we want to take lessons from looking at those examples. So the other kind of common connotation of memory that the word might conjure is something that brings us a little closer home, which is memory in a computer, right? So computer memory. And the reason this is a sort of a more obvious example for us to start with is that all the various steps of what I mentioned in terms of encoding, storing, retrieving, and erasing memory are much more clear, because these are things that we have designed. And so hopefully we know what we're doing. And so I'll just sort of take two examples of the various kinds of memory or storage devices that we use to illustrate, again, some points. So one is is magnetic memory, and the other is phase change memory. And these are slightly different examples. So in magnetic memory, of course, the basis of our ability to store information is spontaneous magnetization. And this spontaneous magnetization is sort of induced in different symmetry-related directions through a read-write head. So the basis of having memory in this case is the presence of symmetry broken states. Likewise, in the case of phase change memory devices, and for those, I'll just say quickly what the so these are materials which can, under operating conditions, exist either as glasses or crystals, and these two phases have different reflectivity and conductivity properties, so they give you contrast, which can be used to store zeros and ones. And the way you generate these bits to be either in the crystalline or the glass states is basically heating it up, and either cooling very fast, in which case you make a glass, or you cool it slowly, in which case you make a crystal, and that gives you the ability to store information. And so one point that emerges from this example is that the process by which I induce a particular memory is a particular protocol in which the system is prepared. Okay, it's sort of, in this context, not so useful to say it that way, but that's something that in general will be of interest. Okay, so there is, in other words, the memory formation is a matter of the protocol or the history of the system under consideration, and is a record of that history. Okay, and yeah.
Would you say that the universe has a memory? For example, in the CMB, about what might
have So. Okay.
A record.
Well, any closed physical system, given the time reversal invariance, obviously has a memory.
Right. Should we, how about a Kindle screen? The Kindle screen has electrophoresis, you know, little dots move to the top or back of the screen.
Right.
And then we read it with our eyes. It's not an automatic reader, but
right.
Holding an image.
And which memory is in our
eyes? It's one of these types of memories, I'm sure.
Which one?
Oh, which one?
It's flash.
I'm not that tech savvy, I don't know. It's probably flash memory, right? Which is sort of the more common memory. But yeah, so yeah, so I think in terms of your question, I don't know the details of what you asked, but one thing that one could ask, and this is going to come up later on, is whether the memory we are talking about is transient or permanent or persistent. And if you have a if this I guess the universe is not in equilibrium. But if there is equilibrium, then you don't, that sort of by definition, you don't have memory. And if you don't have equilibrium, you have memory of initial conditions. And that, but that's sort of a very general thing to say. And in terms of what you asked, in fact, each of the pixels is put in a particular state by whatever mechanism you're using. So, yeah, there is. I mean, so then you have questions like whether it's volatile memory or if it's non-volatile memory. But okay, I don't want to go too far in that direction. Yeah, I mean, you induce the system to be in a particular state. So that's comparable to the memory examples I already gave.
Ink on paper, I mean.
Yeah. So, yeah. Okay, so now before I sort of get on to the kind of examples that we would like to sort of think about more in this program, I'll sort of mention one more thing which does come up as being relevant, but is a sort of a more classical example of a way of looking at memory, which is the Hockfield model, okay, I don't know. The Hockfield network, so this is basically a model where I represent, I imagine synapses as a set of spins and the synaptic activity through a set of couplings. So I write a Hamiltonian, which is where the Si's and Sj's can be plus or minus one. And if I want to now encode a particular image or a particular memory, which is a particular sequence of these spin values, I do so by making a choice of, so let's say I have some, let's call it sigmas, and I'm going to use the index mu to represent a particular pattern that I want to store. Then if I have just one, I define my couplings to be just given by the product of the spins in that pattern. If I have many of them, I sum over these different patterns, and this gives me a way of representing many different memories. This is a particular learning rule. People worry about all kinds of different learning rules. So in this context, one can sort of ask, how many memories can I store, right? And this has been looked at, and there is okay, I mean, the textbook answer for precisely what I describe is that goes as some number, so the number of memories I can store in a way that I can retrieve it faithfully scales as n with some coefficient, okay? And so this is, of course, not an obvious answer, at least to me, because if I think of how many states I have, it's a much larger number of states. So I might optimistically have imagined that I can store a very large number of memories. But this number is basically the number of distinct ferromagnetic states that I can have, which have sort of basins of attraction for each of those memories to be retrieved if I were to start from some initial guess which is within that basin of attraction. Okay? And so this now is what's called an associative memory. So I don't have to know everything. Once I have encoded information in my network, I can start with partial information and retrieve the full information. Okay, and this, I mentioned partly sort of a background, but also this is going to come up in one of the examples that we're going to discuss. Okay, so partly based on what I said, but also just in terms of...
is that statement limited to local?
These are not local, actually. In fact, it's
two-body.
It's two-body, yeah.
Right. If you go to multi-body, then does it scale as n to the number of bodies or something like that, minus one?
I don't think so offhand. I don't know. Yeah. But you mean pairwise, but non-local. That's the combination here. If
okay.
If you have three body, I don't know. If, because see, it's okay. As I said, the what you need is sort of okay. I mean, if you just have one of these, it's sort of a disguised ferromagnetic state, and so what you need is sort of the ability to have whatever number of ferromagnetic states that are present in the system. I don't know offhand if having many body interactions necessarily helps.
P-state Potts model.
Well,
so a P-state
Potts, well, it'll have an exponential number of Glossy minima, but I'm not sure if that will help you encode memories.
Well, the question was how.
Whether if I have many body interactions, will the number of distinct memories I can encode go differently with n? I don't know any result that addresses that, but I would guess not. Yeah. Okay, so let me move on. This is sort of the end of the introduction, so to speak. So what we've sort of given us, I hope I've given a sense of, is there's a certain way of thinking about and talking about memories, which is interesting, and very anecdotally, I've sort of hinted that the kind of questions that are of interest are interesting from the perspectives of physics, biology, computer science, what have you, and some of the key ideas one should be thinking about are, you know, how one might encode, store, retrieve, erase memories. Okay, so this is sort of one. Now, but I haven't yet told you the kind of problems that we are interested in, and this is what I would like to address next. So our program is called Memory Formation in Matter, and of course everything is matter, but we have some more specific things in mind, which are typically condensed matter or more specifically soft matter systems, which typically are driven and are out of equilibrium. Okay, so that's really sort of the scope of where we want to think of and look at memory effects, and I want to go through some of these examples just to illustrate. And then I'll sort of try to So for many of the people in this room, the first thing that might come to your mind when you talk about memory effects is glasses, right? And so we all know that glasses have very strong relaxation effects, falling out of equilibrium, etc. So this is one place where we do expect memory effects. And so one sort of classic problem in which this has been looked at some in some detail is the memory effects in spin glasses. And basically, let me just quickly explain what the phenomenon is that I'm sketching here. And you know, I won't spend too much time dwelling on it because I have a few more examples to go through. And so if you look at the out-of-phase susceptibility, which is measured as you go down in temperature, and then you go up in temperature. So if you do it at some constant rate, you get, I guess I can use color chalk. So, so you get some behavior. And it's not really looking very different, okay? Let me try yellow. Okay. But then, if I were to cool down and then sit at some temperature, okay, and then this, as a function of the waiting time, goes down. But then, if I were to continue cooling further down, this susceptibility values go further back and sort of sit on top of the reference curve. And now if I were to heat back, I find that the system remembers the temperature at which it was aged. And the susceptibility goes through this dip once again. Okay, so this is a classic experiment, and one can sort of try and understand it in terms of the fact that there is, you know, by letting the system sit at this particular temperature, you're allowing it to explore phase space in a certain fashion, which results in this signal. Okay, but the important point from the perspective of memory is that this signal sort of recapitulates the history. If I started at low temperatures, if I didn't know that I had age the system at a particular temperature, the measurement recapitulates this history. Okay, so the next example is something that is also sort of magnetic but undisordered magnets, but this is called return point memory, and many systems show it, but the so the particular so if I I will get this right, so let me just, okay, so that's probably good enough. This is magnetization. So if I have a magnet that exhibits hysteresis, and so if I were to sort of sweep the field over some range, I would have this hysteresis curve. But now, if I were to stop the field on the way up and I decrease the field, I trace another loop which is off the curve that I had earlier. But if I were to sort of continue this sweep up of the magnetic field, at the point where I initially reverse the field, I go back to the earlier curve. Okay, so in other words, if I were to sort of halt a monotonic progress of the field by doing a reversal and I come back, the system remembers the point at which I did the earlier reversal. Okay, and this can be repeated many times over, subject to the condition that at any point I don't exceed the maximum fields that I initially had applied, and if I do so, then the memories at smaller fields are lost. Okay, so this is another phenomenon, and okay, I should go a bit faster. So the other kind of system which exhibits very interesting memory effects are charge density wave systems, and so these are basically, okay, I mean, I won't go into what they are and how to think of it, but I'll just sort of explain simply what the experiment is. Okay, the experiment is that in these systems, which are characterized by sort of various effects, including pinning and disorder, you're looking at electrical conductivity or currents by applying voltages in pulses, and as a function of time, and you repeat these pulses. Okay, and what is found interestingly is that the response of the system in terms of the currents, I'm not going to do a good job of plotting this, but the important part of it, okay, I should be at the end of the examples by now. But okay, so I'll get there in a few minutes. So but the important part of the response is that the currents always turn up as you approach the limit of the size of the pulse. So if as I'm approaching this end, and as if the system sort of anticipates the voltage being turned off, and this happens in a synchronized way regardless of what the pulse duration is. Okay, I will move on because the last two examples I need to talk about at some length, okay, so this is a system where I look at a colloidal suspension or models thereof. I won't make the distinction right now. And these are athermal, and I subject them to oscillatory deformation. Okay, and I look, let's say at the end of each sweep, I look at whether particles have moved or not moved. Okay, and what characterizes the particular training is the amplitude, and I can ask, if I were to sort of train the system at a given amplitude, and then I stop after some number of cycles, and then I now do a sweep of amplitudes, and measure at each amplitude how many particles move. Okay. Then if I haven't trained the system very well yet, I get some behavior that looks like this, where this is the training amplitude. But if I keep going and I sort of repeat this many, many times, then I eventually get a behavior that looks like this. Okay, where below the training amplitude nothing happens, and beyond the training amplitude particles begin to move if I strain them at that oscillatory amplitude. And so something that is interesting, which comes out as a notion in this, is that I can also not only do this at one particular amplitude, but I can do this at many amplitudes, let's say two for the sake of discussion. And if I again, do the same experiment, what I find is at partial training, some behavior like this. But if I train the system fully, I then go to basically this situation where I have lost information of all but the largest amplitude. Okay. However, if while I'm training the system, I keep perturbing it by addition of some noise, right, which could be thermal noise in principle, then the memory of the different amplitudes at which I'm training persists, okay, and this can be read off even if I train the system for very long times. And this is sort of a curious effect where...
What is the y-axis here? This is the amplitude of displacement.
So I basically, so if you know, if by some means, let's say at the end of one cycle, I have some criterion for asking if a given particle has moved by some threshold, beyond some threshold value. So this is the fraction of particles that are moved beyond that threshold value. Okay. Okay. So one of the interesting aspects of this is that the addition of noise actually helps restore the ability to remember, which a noise-free system does not have. Okay, and so one can do the same kind of well, computer experiments, in this case with glasses, and you find somewhat similar behaviors, but not entirely. And I'll say something about it later on if there's enough time. But now the last example I want to talk about, okay, so before I do that, let me just say that if I just look at a single memory, and I ask, why is it I have this particular memory of the training amplitude? One can sort of offer a fairly simple-minded physical picture, which is that as I sort of strain the system back and forth, particles will bump into each other and push each other out of the way. And in the steady state, I reach a situation where if I look at where different particles are and sort of where all they move, I'm making a bad cartoon, they stay out of each other's way, right? So I've reached a particular state which has all the particles not seeing the others through the entire cycle, okay? But it also turns out that if I were to change now the amplitude of straining by a small amount, then there's a large number of collisions, and that's basically what you see here as a signal. Okay, so there's some kind of a marginal state that you've trained the system into. Okay, so the last example is at one level not sort of very obvious to state as an example of memory, but as you will see, so if I wanted to make a self-assembled structure of a certain shape, right, and I want to do this through the assembly of a large number of components, I can choose the interaction. Or you know, for simplicity, let's say if I have some assembly, each particle is different, right? And in the assembled structure, each particle is sitting next to some particular neighbors. I can choose the interaction such that only those interactions are attractive and all others are not. And this problem, even though it's not very obviously a memory problem, if you compare it to something that I mentioned at the beginning, is reminiscent of a memory network, right? There are important differences, which Zorana can tell you. But in this case also, I can ask, as a function of the number of components I have, how many different structures I can train. The same kind of questions that came up earlier. And you get, in fact, somewhat similar answers. You can sort of make a phase diagram where this is the number of structures and temperature. So there is a region where the retrieval of the different structures is feasible. As I increase the number of different structures, I encode, and beyond which I generate sort of combinations of the structures that I sought to encode. Okay, so this is another problem where some questions similar to the questions in the other examples arises. Okay. So now, there I start with examples So basically, if I now think of what sort of similar, I mean, there's quite a zoo of different types of problems. What's common between them? So one thing that seems to be common between, I mean, anything I say here may not apply to every single example. Generally speaking, I seem to have sort of driven systems which are out of equilibrium that are, in fact, driven to some kind of fixed point. Okay? The kind of asymptotic states that these go into can be characterized in some way as being marginal. And this is true, for example, of this example, the charge density wave example. And the other feature that I mentioned earlier, though you know it's a question mark how generally this is applicable, it's a very curious effect, which is the stabilization of models through noise. Which is not obvious, and in all these cases, if we sort of contrast with something like encoding or an image or something, which is the typical kind of task that you give a neural net, you have sort of fairly low-dimensional memories and retrieval tasks, right? So we're looking at sort of pulse duration, a set of memory field values, etc. And on the other hand, the systems themselves have very large degrees of freedom. Okay, so so large degrees of freedom. But the memories are not. So one is sort of generating, in principle, some ensembles of states that correspond to the memories that you're attempting to store. So it's important to understand how to characterize those ensembles. Given these examples and considerations, we can sort of list a set of questions, and we hope we will have some interesting answers coming out of the the interactions during this workshop. So one is, what constitutes a memory? And, so there are different kinds of memory, and one should be thinking about what properties does a system need to have systems. Normally we think of plasticity as being associated with our ability to put systems in sort of pre-programmed states, which remember what we did to it. Now, given the examples that I mentioned where noise plays a role in stabilizing memories, how do we in general think about plasticity going beyond sort of material science definition? So how many memories can we store in a given system? Are there interesting sort of entropy signatures of encoding memories? And likewise, okay. So these are some questions, and I probably had a few points to sort of talk about, but I will. Just mentioned that a few key points. I think in all the examples, at least in the majority of the examples, one is looking at systems that are characterized by complex landscapes. One is also looking at systems where history sort of matters in a fairly detailed fashion, right? There is this phenomenon of marginal stability of states, and one has to think in terms of effective temperatures and other parameters in some cases, and one has notions of basins of attraction, attractors. So these are sort of some key keywords. But then if we go to so the list of questions here, I said some things about storage capacity, for example, in sort of well-studied other systems. But in all the kind of systems we talked about, we really haven't addressed this. So this is something that's something to think about. And in terms of entropy and memory, there is sort of recent interesting work looking at, on the one hand, sort of special structures that these driven systems create, exhibiting hyperuniformity, and correspondingly, when one looks at sort of information density and other measures of entropy, one has clear entropic signatures, but exactly how to think about it is still something that we don't understand. And in terms of different kinds of memory, one thing that's sort of clear from the examples that I gave is that really there are different you know, like, this example here is one where both the dimensionality of the memories that I'm talking about and the complexity of the imprinting process are extensive, right? Whereas in examples such as this, both the dimensionality of the memory as well as what I do to the system, the complexity of the imprinting task are simpler. And that's sort of, then, as I said, instead of thinking about detailed microscopic structure of state, one has to perhaps think about ensembles of states which are characterized by a few special properties. So these are some things that we will be discussing further in the coming weeks, and I think I will stop there and leave a couple of minutes if some of my co-organizers or anybody else has something to say.
Could you say whether, in your opinion, dissipation is necessary for the formation of memories? That is the second law of thermodynamics central to this? Or are there different kinds of memories, some of which?
Okay, so in fact, in all the cases that I mentioned, dissipation is always present. Okay, is it always necessary? No, from the simple-minded examples I gave, right? But if I'm going to sort of look at a driven system which is going to go into some well-defined asymptotic state, typically dissipation will be. Will be present. I don't think memory formation meets dissipation as a necessary.
But a counterexample would be a spin echo. Is you encode times between your pulses, but there's no dissipation will kill it eventually, but it's not necessary to make it.
Another example is reversible computing, where people thought that dissipation was essential to form a record of what the computation was, but it turned out there were examples where it wasn't true.
So question of
what about short-term and long-term memory? Because that is somehow not figuring. Because we know in human brain it happens that you can erase long-term or short-term in the other way. Yeah. So in mechanical memory, do you have similar examples?
Yeah, I mean, it's in some of the examples that I mentioned, I didn't emphasize it, but there are memories that are transient memories, and those that are not. So one can make the distinction between short-term and long-term memories. I don't know if it's the same thing I don't know if there are interesting analogies to make between long-term and short-term memories, how they're stored in the brain versus, but they are there.
Thank you, Sri.